Exodus.
Leading 2 million people across the Sinai wilderness is no picnic in the best of times. 1615 BC, the year that Moses did that, was not the best of times. In addition to the scorching heat, the stinging scorpions, the poisonous asps, razor-like stones underfoot, untracked desert valleys, they went to dead ends. There were the oases that were filled with marauding bands of Amalekites. It's little wonder that being forbidden to take the only road that crosses wilderness, the Via Damaris, it's no wonder that Moses asked his father-in-law, "Lead us. We need help to get there." It's a good choice. Hobab was a Midianite shepherd. As a shepherd, he knew the wilderness. He knew where the water holes were, and they would need those water holes. He was of that sub-branch of the Midianites, known as the Kenites, or metal workers, and as such, he knew where the assets of the desert were, where all the ore was. As a Kenite who lived near the Suez, or the Kenite tribe lived over near Eilat on the Red Sea, he would know the Middle Sinai better than anyone else. Excellent choice. The Bible record is unclear as to whether Hobab accepted the invitation by Moses to lead them. In fact, it rather indicates he did not, because it says, "No, I will stay with my people." But if he didn't, some of his descendants did. Because when they got to the Promised Land, we find the other side of the story. It's in Judges, the first chapter, in the 16th verse. "And the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up out of the city of palm trees with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lieth to the south of Arad, and they went and dwelt among the people." Simple story. You lead us, when we get the Promised Land, we'll share it with you. They got to the Promised Land, it was shared with them. They were given an inheritance. They were given the city of Arad. A simple story, a simple lesson. Those who help the Lord's people, the Lord rewards. Jesus put it simply, Matthew 10, 40-42. "He that receiveth you receiveth me, and he that receiveth me receiveth him that sent me. He that receiveth a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. He that receiveth a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. And whosoever shall give to drink unto one of these least ones a cup of cold water in the name of the disciple, verily I say unto you, he shall not lose his reward." Simple story, simple lesson. We can close our books and finish. It's not that simple. The lesson isn't that easy. There are at least three clues that suggest that Moses made a wrong decision in inviting Hobab to be their guide. These are the clues we want to look at, and then look at the lesson a second time. First thing is, why did they need a guide? Well, that was obvious. The desert was formidable. It was barren. It was trackless. They needed somebody to get them across it. How would they get through to the Promised Land through this barren wilderness without a guide? But you know, the story is interesting. Ray Lumley read his part of the story. He read his verses 29 to 32. I want to pick up the reading in verses 33 and 34. "Immediately after they asked Hobab," notice how the story continues, "and they departed from the mount of the Lord 3 days' journey, and the Ark of the Covenant went before them in 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them, and the cloud of the Lord was upon them by day when they went out of the camp." They had a guide. The Midianite, the Kenite, he knew the wilderness. He did not know the wilderness like God. God made it. He knew every turn in the wilderness. Paul told us about God. Think of God's perspective. He's up there. He could see behind every hill. He could see where the Amalekites were camped. Think of that cloud. You're there in the desert. A lot of winds in the desert because the heat draws the wind. And the wind would blow through and here's a cloud standing perfectly still. Which way the wind blew, the cloud stood still. Then the cloud gets up and starts moving this way and the wind's blowing that way. What a cloud! What a guide! Did they need the Kenite when they had a better guide? But that guide up there, it took faith to follow. Man likes a guide he can see, prefers a guide he can talk face to face with. He can ask a question, get a straight answer instead of a moving cloud, a will-o'-the-wisp, but a strong will. It raises a question, doesn't give an answer. Look at the second clue. Hobab was a Kenite. That's scriptural. You read that. But let's look in Genesis 15:19, which predicted their entrance into the promised land. And it said when they were to go into the promised land, that land would be inhabited by 10 tribes, that they were to drive out. And the first one it mentions are the Kenites. The Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Kadmonites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. They were to drive the Kenite out of the land, and Moses brings the Kenite into the land. Ah, but you say, not all Kenites are Kenites. That's true. Like anything, that's a generality, they all Kenites are bad. There were good Kenites and bad. A proselyte was welcome to the land. And there are indications that Moses' father-in-law had faith. It was Moses' father-in-law, Hobab, Jethro if you prefer, who suggested that they had the council of 70 judges to assist Moses. It was Moses' father-in-law's daughter, Moses' wife, Zipporah, who circumcised her son, and not Moses. It suggests it was the measure of faith. And yet one questions how strong the faith was, because the only answer was, I don't want to go. I want to stay with my people. He was drawn to his own people more than to the promised land. So it's very questionable. You know, there was one Kenite later in history. We're going to move down history 600 years. No, not that long. About 100 years. It was a Kenite who was very good. A Kenite who was an Israelite all the way. A Kenite who fought in a battle and won the war. A female Kenite. Her name was Jael, the wife of Heber. We read about her in Judges 4:11. She's the one who put the nail in Sisera's head and killed him in that battle of Deborah. Now Heber the Kenite, that's her husband, which was of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had severed himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent under the plain of Zaanaim, which is by Kadesh. You can read more about that in Judges 4:17 and 5:24. This Kenite did not stay around a rod, but severed himself, implying that he did not have a relationship with the other Kenites. Here was a Kenite who was a proselyte, not a Kenite who was Jewish-oriented. He was oriented toward the Jews, but really, at heart, he was a Kenite. Who were the Kenites? Just a little sidetrack here. The Kenites were metal workers. Their name means workers in metal, according to Nelson's Bible Dictionary. It comes from the word Cain, Kenite. Not Cain, the son of Adam, but Cain, the son of the other line, the son of the line of that Cain, the one. It was called Tubal Cain. You read about him in Genesis 4:22.
and Zilla, she bore Tubal Cain, and instructor of every artificer in brass and iron, and the sister of Tubal Cain was Naamah. So all along, the Cainites from Tubal Cain were the artificers in brass. Well, artificing in metal was a very important skill for Israel to have. They had a tabernacle to build. Later it was going to be a brazen serpent. They needed these skills. They used these skills before that, unfortunately. Remember that time when Moses was in the mountain? And they were worried because he was so long in the mountain. And they went to Aaron, make us a golden calf. How did Aaron know how to make a golden calf? He had Kenites along to show them the metalworking skill. And it's suggested by Nelson and others that that's where the skill came for the golden calf, was from the Kenites. Yes, they had metalworking to be done, but they did not need the Kenites to do it. When God was ready for his metalworking, he says, I'll instruct you in metalworking. Exodus 31:2-4. See, I've called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, the tribe of Judah, and I have filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom and understanding and knowledge of all matter of workmanship, to devise cunning work, to work in gold and in silver and in brass. They didn't need the Kenites there. The Kenite metalworking produced the golden calf. God's metalworker produced the tabernacle and the brazen serpent. So our second clue is that the Kenite was not that productive. But the third clue we want to look at is a rod. Judges 1:16, we read that earlier. We'll read it again. But before we get to that, we want to go a little bit into the history of a rod. A rod means fugitive. And it was named after the king. The king's name was Arad, who built the city originally. We read the history of the city in Numbers 21:1-2. When King Arad, the Canaanite, a fugitive Canaanite, dwelt in the south, heard tell that Israel came by way of the spies, then he fought against Israel, and he took some of them prisoner. And Israel vowed a vow unto the Lord, and said, if you will give this people to my hand, I will utterly destroy the city. And they had two cities, Arad and Zionim. Zionim means utterly destroyed. But Arad they didn't destroy. They gave it to the Kenites to inhabit. Sort of makes you think of King Saul, doesn't it, when he came back from the slaughter of the Amalekites. And Samuel says, what do I hear? Thought you're destroyer with it. What's that cattle I hear? Well, that's a gift to the Lord. To obey is better than sacrifice. So he dwelt in Arad. Well, now we're going to pick up a rod in more recent times. Some of you knew, or Brother Jack Campbell had decided last year. Jack was the rebuilder of a rod. He was the main contractor to rebuild the city. In fact, he was the one who pinpointed the tell and got the archaeologists digging it up. And in that tell, and I've been there, I've seen this, there's a foundation, a structure, that is almost a perfect duplicate of Solomon's temple. They built that as a center of worship in Arad. That's good. They wanted to worship God. No, that's bad. They were not supposed to build temples in other cities. Listen to the word of the law. Deuteronomy 16:16. 3 times in a year shall all the males appear before the Lord thy God in the place which he shall choose, in the Feast of Unleavened Bread, in the Feast of Weeks, in the Feast of Tabernacle, and they shall not appear before the Lord empty. When Israel split into two kingdoms, 10 tribes in the north, 2 in the south, Jeroboam knew the power of God's word. He didn't like it. He said, I'm trying to form a new kingdom in the north, and 3 times a year, they're all going to go to Jerusalem. And that's going to pull them to the south. I don't want them to go south. And here's Jeroboam's words. 1 Kings 12:26-30. Jeroboam said in his heart, now shall the people return to the house of David, if the people go to sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem. Then shall the heart of the people turn again unto their Lord, even unto Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they'll kill me, and they'll go back again to Rehoboam. So he took counsel, and he made two golden calves, and said to the people, it's too much to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of Egypt. And he set one in Bethel in the south, and one in Dan in the north, and this became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one, even unto Dan. Parallel worship was a sin. He was trying to model it after Jewish worship, but he was seeking to polarize. Jerusalem united Israel. Other places of worship polarized Israel. Arad, Dan, Bethel polarized Israel. It drew it apart. You know, on these feasts, when they would come from all over the country, that was quite a trek. It took many days, sometimes a week or more. They all did it by foot. And to pass the time, they would sing songs. And there were 15 songs they would sing as they'd go along the way. It's called the Psalms of Degrees, Psalm 120 through 134. And as they would top that last ridge of mountains, coming from the north, the south, the east, the west, toward Jerusalem, they would see pilgrims coming from all directions. And they were almost at the last of the psalm. And they would sing that Psalm 133rd as they saw the others coming. How good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. They began to realize that oneness that drew some pictures. And not the polarization that not only Dan and Bethel, but a rod picture. Israel needed guides, they thought. Israel went to Hobab, the Kenite, for guides. And the Kenites knew the desert. But the Kenites did not know the promised land. They knew the wilderness, but they didn't know the destination. The Kenites were not the guides to be used. Now let's contrast that with another experience. We're going to go down history 1,000 years. Hobab. We're going to go past the captivity, 70 years in Babylon. People returning under close hardship to Jerusalem. The city laying in ruins. The project before them immense. To rebuild the temple, to rebuild the city walls. The need for help tremendous because there were few people that were there. The people around them, mostly hostile. But not all hostile. There were the Samaritans. The Samaritans, we're going to look a little bit more about them, but they were people that said, we'd like to help you. Let us be your Hobab. Let us be your guide and help you build the city. The story is found in Ezra 4, first four verses. Now when the adversaries of Judah, and by adversaries here, he's not talking ones who were adversaries at that point in time. But you really need to read now, those who became the adversaries of Judah, the Samaritans. When the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity built the temple unto the Lord God of Israel, then they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers and said, let us build with you. We also seek your God just as you do. We sacrifice unto him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyr, which brought us up hither. But Zerubbabel and Joshua and the rest of the chief of the fathers said unto them, we have nothing to do with you. You have nothing to do with us to build the house unto our God. We ourselves, together with, will build unto the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded. Then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them. Then, how rude was Zerubbabel of Joshua. Here was volunteer labor. Here was an offer of friendship. And what a slap in the face. We've got nothing to do with you. We'll do it ourselves. Who were the people of the land? They said, we worship your God ever since the days of Esarhaddon. Now that story is a long one. We're going to go over it very briefly. It's found in 2 Kings 17, 24 to 29. I'm going to read it because it gives us the background for this contrasting lesson. The king of Assyria brought men from Babylon, from Kusma, Abba, Hamath, Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. These were not Jewish. And they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof. And so it was at the beginning of their dwelling there. They didn't fear Jehovah. But Jehovah sent lions among them, and he slew some of them. And so they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, "The nation which thou hast removed and placed in the cities of Samaria don't know the manner of the God of the land, Jehovah. And behold, he sends lions and they slay them because they don't know the manner of the God." So the king of Assyria said, "Well, I'll help you." He said, "Carry forth one of the priests who you brought from thence. Let them go and dwell there, and let him teach them the manner of the God." So then one of the priests whom they had carried away to Samaria came. He had dwelt at Bethel before, and he taught them how they should fear the Lord. Howbeit, every nation made gods of their own and put them in the places in the high places, which the Samaritans made. Every nation is in this city where they dwelt. So now you have the Samaritans. They desired to know more about God. They were sent a priest to instruct them in the ways of God. These are the Samaritans that came to them and said, "Let us help you." What an opportunity to witness, to give them more instruction about God. Instead, Jehovah says, "Nothing to do with us. We're going to do it ourselves." Because the Samaritans had established, just like the Kenites did, a parallel religion. What do I mean by parallel religion? It's identified in verse 33, 2 Kings 17. After this priest came, then they feared Jehovah and served their own gods. They feared Jehovah and served their own gods after the manner of the nations whom they carried away from them. They just added another god to the panoply. They had increased the fold. But it was not a conversion. It was an adaptation. It was a parallel. The Samaritans were as close to Judaism as the Kenites were. That same kind of relationship between the two and Judaism. Another lesson in their manifold. Israel, finding their backs to the wall on so many occasions, repetitively sought alliances with the nations around them. And I think many of us can recall the singing denunciation of Isaiah the prophet in Isaiah 31:1. "Woe to them that go down to Egypt for help, and stay in horses and trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But they look not at the Holy One of Israel, neither seek the Lord." I would suggest that this is the lesson of Hobab the Kenite. It was a lesson of a sincere, wrong decision. It was a lesson of inviting the Kenites into the land instead of trusting the crowd and the Lord to guide them. This lesson is forcible, even in our own day. We're traveling through a wilderness. They traveled an untracked path. We're traveling a narrow way. A way that goes through countless turns of sin and evil. We don't know the way. There are many times we feel the need for guidance. We feel the need for help. We reach out. We reach out to others who say they know the land better. They've got a better grasp on the psychology of sin. They've got a better grasp on how to deal with the specifics of sin and time is a marital problem, spouse problems, abuse problems, whatever they may be. And they say, "We need this guidance that's there. Hobab, guide us to the promised land. If you guide us, we'll share the promised land with you." The one answer is to invite the Kenite along. The other answer is to take the answer of Zerubbabel and say, "What have we to do with you?" But that's so exclusive. There's such an exclusivity about that concept of saying, "We'll do it alone. We don't need your help." Many times we really do feel the need for that help. And yet the Lord has promised to be the guiding cloud, that he would direct us over the way. That takes faith. Not quite so easy. God was a jealous God. And God did demand exclusivity from Israel. Isaiah 52:11. You depart from your house. Touch no unclean thing. Go ye out of the midst of her, be ye clean that bear the vessels of the Lord. Ezra 10:11. Now therefore make confession of the Lord God of your fathers, and do his pleasure, and separate yourself from the people of the land and from strange wives. There was a mark of exclusivity. You can only marry a Jew. Paul picked that up. The Jew had it in Ezra 10:2. You've taken strange wives with people of the land. Paul in 1 Corinthians 7:39 says, marry, yes, but only in the Lord. He brings down that same exclusiveness to it. And then he broadens the principle. He goes beyond marriage. In 2 Corinthians 6:14, be not unequally yoked with the unbeliever. What fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? What communion hath light with darkness? Exclusivity is there. And there's a reason for that exclusivity. Zerubbabel saw it. Moses at one point in time did not see it. And that was, you want guidance. Get guidance from a guide who knows the way. You want guidance in spiritual matters. You want guidance in application of spiritual principles. You want guidance in applying truth to the daily circumstances of life. We need that guidance. Every one of us needs that guidance. But all this guidance must come down to one thing. We need guidance in knowing the mind of God. How do we get guidance in finding the mind of God? 1 Corinthians 2:11. What man knows the things of man except he has the spirit of man? Even so, the things of God knoweth no man but the spirit of God. You want guidance, you must look to those who have the spirit of God. But are we so exclusive that we say the spirit of God is only with us? I hope not. That's bigotry. Plain out and out bigotry. How about the argument then that, yes, there can be spirit-begotten ones out there. Put it in mouth, you know, I'm doing this now. Excuse that. That may be. I think it is. I think there may be. I think there may be many spirit-begotten. That's a different argument. That's not my subject matter. It's irrelevant to our subject. It doesn't make any difference. The reason it's irrelevant to the subject is even if I'm correct, and there are spirit begotten ones in Babylon, they are not God's mouthpiece. Simple as that. Revelation 3:16 is very clear. In the prayer to Laodicea, he says, I will spew thee out of my mouth. They are not the spokesman. Jeremiah 8 was referenced by Brother Eldridge this morning. And it does talk about some who say the harvest is past and some is ended, and we are not saved. Ones who, I believe, are spirit begotten ones. Ones who at the time that they're speaking in Jeremiah 8:14, are speaking from a definite location, a geographical location. They had just said before this prophecy, let us enter into the defense city, Babylon, and be silent there. They are not the spokesman. They didn't say, let us enter the defense cities and write books there. They didn't say, let us enter the defense cities and be the leaders there. But let us enter the defense cities and be silent there. They are ones who are spoken of later as those who don't achieve the highest of salvation. The great company. Not the leadership to be looked for. So whether or not God has spirit begotten, I think he does. They are not the ones that he is using as the guide. The question is, do we take the Kenite along? The Kenite that Moses invited, I would rather save my own people. The Kenites that we may invite, the Kenites say,
I'd rather stay with my own God. That's your privilege. No reason for animosity. But no reason to look for direction. We have a guide. Moses had a guide. A guide that was too hard to follow, because that guide, that cloud, was still standing still for a year at a time. Wouldn't move anyplace. Wasn't guiding him anywhere. Easy to get discouraged with such a guide.
Inactive. Stagnant. But nevertheless, a guide who knew not only the wilderness, a guide who knew the promised land, a guide who knew them, how to test them, how to try them, how to probe them, how to prove them. A guide who wanted them to be united as a people and not polarized in 21 different directions. A guide who said, when you get to the promised land, worship me in Jerusalem. Come together. Have your thrice annual conventions. Your thrice feasts to the Lord. Come for a week at a time. Get to know each other. You from Benjamin. And you from Issachar. And you from Zebulun. And from Naphtali. And from Dan. All coming together. Not building a parallel temple and a rod.
Not setting up a worship that is sincere toward the God of Israel, but includes the gods of the lands around them. Seek to be pure.
Sounds horrible. Sounds exclusive. Sounds like the direction of a jealous God.
And that's what I believe it is. Yes, brethren, we need help. We need direction. We don't need the Kenite. We need the cloud.